We live by two words now, Sean. You know, what if? Yeah. What if we knew about sepsis?
This week marks Sepsis Awareness Day. You've no doubt heard of it, but can you spot the signs? Well, let me explain.
Let me explain with Sean Defoe, a News Talk original.
Welcome to the podcast. Very glad to have your ears this week for a kind of a difficult topic and a much longer podcast than we would usually do. But this week marks World Sepsis Awareness Day. And as part of that, I've been speaking to some people with personal histories and stories related to a condition that most of us probably don't know that much about beyond the name. So this week we're exploring it in depth. And first, let's get an idea of the impact that it can have on a family. Joe and Karen Hughes lost their son Sean to sepsis. He was a rapper known as Lil Red. And when we picked up the conversation, the family were telling me all about Sean.
So Sean was 15 and a half. He was an up and coming rap artist. He wrote and recorded all his own material. He actually had a scholarship in school, the secondary school he was in, which Clash to Own, called The Rising Tide, and they would have really, he wanted to be a producer. And they would have put him on the right path for that. But he was awarded a scholarship and he was absolutely thrilled with that. But besides that, Sean had many, many friends. He really did. And everyone loved him. He was an absolute little gentleman, he was. And everyone just took to him. He was that kind of kid. You know, I used to say, I like a magnet. People just attract you all the time, you know. And he knew everybody. You couldn't walk down the street without Sean stopping every few minutes to talk to someone or shake their hand or give them a hug or, you know, so. And he had respect for everyone. He was really wise beyond his years as well for his age, you know. And people used to think he was actually older, you know. So he had a great outlook on life, Sean did, and was very, very positive. You know, and yeah, I could go on for days telling you about Sean. I really could, you know.
You know, we were told, yeah, Sean could walk into any room and make a friend, you know. He was, and we found out the friends of Sean have called him their role model. You know, that's something that will always stick with me, you know. But he had his whole life ahead of him, and he was going to be destined for great things. Because from an early age, with his character and things we'd be hearing back, myself and Karen, we knew that he was destined for good things, you know.
It sounds like the kind of fellow who just lights up a room. And he was very fashion conscious as well, am I right in that?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
he was up to date with all the latest fashion and the runners and all the Stone Island gear and everything that was the fashion he'd save up for and he'd get, you know. A young man and the haircuts, the hair had to be perfect all the time. You know, you would be surprised if he's caught Sean in the shower two or three times a day, changing his clothes to go back out. He's just doing regular things that teenagers do, you know.
And he was a natural performer as well by the sounds of it, but he had actually performed on pretty big stages.
He did. He actually performed in Crow Park. He performed in the National Concert Hall. He performed in the Aviva Stadium. He performed in
The Helix,
the Ballymun. It was an African week. And they actually asked Sean, would he rap that week? And he did, not a bother to him. And he would have just performed anywhere he was asked, you know, at a drop of a hat. But yeah, he done all the big events, you know. He did.
He sounds like a great kid. Tell us then, I suppose, to get into the sadder side of the story, what happened?
So on January the 8th, 2018, Sean had came home from school and he was displaying flu-like symptoms. And he said, I don't feel great. He said, I feel like I have a flu coming on me. So I said, look, I said, the best thing you can do, I said, you're off tomorrow. Go to bed, sweat it out of you. I gave him Nurofen. And probably a Lemsip that night. And I said, look, try and sweat it out of you as you do. So the next morning I heard him, he was on his iPad laughing and giggling. I said, he must be feeling somewhat better, you know. So by that evening then, Tuesday evening, he actually said to his sister, Zoe, I don't feel great again. He said, it's like it's coming and going on me, you know. So I said, just see how you are in the morning. I said, so I woke him, I went to wake him for school on the Wednesday morning. And he said to me, I feel absolutely rotten. He said, so I said, okay. I said, he was a bit chesty at that stage and sniffling and the usual flu-like symptoms, you know. But he said, I feel drained. He said, I've no energy. And so I said, look, I said, I'll ring the doctor, see, can I get an appointment? So I was lucky enough to get an appointment at 11:30 that morning. So I brought Sean down to the family GP and she checked him over. She said he has a chest infection, an influenza and a high fever. And she said, I'm going to give you an antibiotic in case it progresses to pneumonia. So I said, okay. So we're literally in the surgery for 10 minutes and Joe was outside to give him a lift home. I got his prescription then, got the antibiotic into him straight away when I came home. And the usual day, and giving him his vitamin C's, oranges and stuff like that, you know, to build up his immune system. So then by that night, then he was coughing a lot more. And I said, the antibiotic is probably not getting into his system because he's actually coughing up phlegm now at this stage, you know. So by Thursday, or Wednesday night, actually, he came in to me. I was in bed and I was checking on him every now and again, you know. And he came in to me and he was actually literally lying on my floor and he said, I feel like I'm going to die. And I said, okay, I said, well, people do say that when they have flu as well. You know, the way that they feel rotten. So he kind of in and out of sleep and stuff like that. So towards the morning then he said, don't feel great again. He said, I actually feel worse. So by that stage, I was getting a bit concerned and I was saying, will I bring him into the hospital or not? And then at that time, I don't know whether you remember, the Aussie flu had hit Ireland in 2018. And it was actually ads on the telly from the HSC telling you not to bring anyone to hospital that has a flu. And that's what Sean was being treated for. So, and then it was only later then we found out that Sean would have been turned away because he only had a flu and he was already on an antibiotic. So the outcome there would have been a lot different maybe, you know. So I said, you know what, I'm going to actually bring him back down to his GP in the morning. Maybe she could give me a letter to send him in because he doesn't seem to be getting any better. That was a Thursday night. We were watching TV together. I was on one sofa, Sean was on the other. Didn't leave his side and he was breathless at this stage as well and trying to talk in between breaths. And he actually said to me, you can watch that crap you watch on Netflix, he said. And he said, I don't mind. And he just stopped talking. And I knew straight away I was trying to wake him and I couldn't wake him. And I was calling his name and I called for Joe. He'd stopped breathing at that stage. I called for Joe and Joe ran down and administered CPR to Sean while I phoned the paramedics then. And they got him into Temple Street. We hadn't a clue what had happened to Sean. And it was 6:30 Friday morning, the 12th of January 2018. We were told that there was no hope for Sean, that the machines would have to be turned off because there'd be catastrophic injury done to his brain. Yeah, so we were just thrown into turmoil then and we hadn't a clue because he was being treated for a flu and a chest infection. You know, and then the next few hours then he was dead. Yeah.
Look, my heart goes out to both of you. It must have been an absolutely horrendous time and he can still see, you know, in you. It's obviously not pleasant to talk about. Joe, I suppose one of the scariest things for people who are listening to this is you did everything right along the way. And I know I can remember chest infections and flus that I've had that sound very similar and a lot of people will have. You know, that's how this gets in. It's not something that's very easy to pick up.
Yeah, I'd be heard. Look, our lives changed from that day onwards. We've been empty feeling since Sean passed away, and we talk about Sean every day. And it's important. It's an important thing to us to keep his memory alive. And that's why we set up our campaign, the Red's Legacy Accepts Awareness Campaign. You know, you say. We understand that it's very hard to pick up. And our whole campaign is around sepsis awareness and the signs and symptoms. And we've liaised many, many times with the HSC, you know, for if it's something that's so hard to detect, if a child or any person is presenting themselves at the GP or hospital, why don't they test for that first? Because it's so hard to rule it out.
Rule it out, yeah.
Go over the top and rule it out. Because if it's not sepsis, thank God. Whatever it is, you've caught it early. You know, one of the things that stick with us is, you know, us as parents, we didn't know anything about sepsis, you know. We live by two words now, Sean. You know, what if?
Yeah.
What if we knew about sepsis? What if the three different sets of medical professionals knew about sepsis? You know, would Sean be still with us today? They're the words that haunt us, you know, yeah. What if?
And it was only after, it was 2 weeks later, Sean had passed away. And we found out then that John had died from sepsis. And the GP said to me, have you heard of it? And I said, I did hear of it, I said, but I never would have related it to the illness that John had. I always used to think it was maybe from a cough that wasn't treated because it was known as blood poisoning then. So we knew very little about it. So that's why we started then our research into it to see what had killed our son, you know.
You know, when John passed away first, and I wanted to Google, I wanted to find out what this word was, sepsis. I never heard of before. It could have been like a tropical disease. I never knew what it was. So we Googled as we did, and there was a national sepsis program which was set up in 2014, but there was nothing in it. This is what led us to stand up our own campaign. And we, unfortunately, whichever way you look at it, we had to petition the agency, and we had them in front of a committee in the Oireachtas a year and a half ago, asking them to ramp up their awareness for the public and in the healthcare setting. Not enough is being done in this country around sepsis. And they have come up trumps. It has happened. They've sent us the first draft of the 5-year action plan on the strategy for sepsis from the HSE, which we hope it will come to fruition. It looks great on paper, Sean, but when we see it in the flesh, we'll be happy, you know. Well, everything that we do, what gets us up out of bed now is our grandson. His name is Sean too. He's named after our son. He has a lot of his temperaments and his personality traits, and you know. But our lives were shattered after our son passed away from a preventable death. You know, sepsis is the world's leading cause of preventable death and disabilities. And it kills 11 million people, an average of 11 million people worldwide. You know, there's an average of 8 deaths a day in Ireland along from sepsis. That's only what's reported. They're not figures we make up, Sean. They're from the National Statistics Office and the Royal College of Surgeons of Ireland. We didn't make them up. If we were to make them up, Sean, we wouldn't make them as drastic as the truth. You know. But you know, we host a lot of public awareness events, and we do a lot of work through social media, you know. Again, with September being Sepsis Awareness Month and it's 14th September being World Sepsis Day, we have a number of things on the go. And as I said, every year it goes from strength to strength. But we're just glad now the agency have come on board. And it's unfortunate that we had to get them in front of the Oireachtas committee. But that's what had to be done. And I see they've done the job.
When you say, you know, the what if, It's a horrible thing to have to ask, but maybe bring me inside the conversations that you guys would have had with the doctors and with medical professions afterwards, because it sounds like, Karen, you were doing everything you could to treat what you thought he had, and really, it should be up to them to spot this.
And I've always said, Sean, that the onus shouldn't be on the parents. That information should be in your face, literally, like other campaigns around illnesses in Ireland, and it just seemed to be very hidden. You know, when we went to look for it then, and we were like, why isn't this in the public domain? Because it's a very sinister disease that is preventable, you know, and we just couldn't fathom that it wasn't out there for the public knowledge. You know, like us, like I should have known about it. Joe should have known about it. We hadn't a clue. You know?
You know, at the beginning of our campaign, as I say, we're coming up to Sean's 7th anniversary. And at the start of our campaign, at one stage, Sean, we had more sepsis awareness material in our house than there was in all of Ireland. The HSC were not putting out any posters, any social media posts to do with sepsis. It wasn't even listed on their website. Everything else from scabies to tetanus to cancer, stroke, everything. Sepsis wasn't there. Sepsis wasn't like it is now, though.
Yes.
And that's all down to Little Red's legacy. You know, sepsis training now is mandatory for all the healthcare officials. And I'm not sure if it's every 3 or every 4 years. That's a direct result of Little Red's legacy. You know, we can go on and go on what has been done since our campaign. We had to bring them in front of the Oireachtas. There's a time that we've been in there more times than some of the politicians. We've been in there to give our sepsis awareness presentation. We take time out of our life to go around schools, colleges, and sports clubs to give our sepsis awareness presentation, which we think is something that the HSC should be doing. We don't get a salary out of this. We don't look for a tap on the back. We don't look for... everything's not a follow-up opportunity to us. We don't get any funding. We don't ask for any. We're not a charity. We do. So what if people don't have to go to a week on show? When we reached out to find out what this is all about, there was nothing. Now, there's plenty.
And as well as that, Sean, another thing that we said, you know, we couldn't learn about sepsis and what Sean had died from and not tell other people about it because we couldn't let another family go through what we go through every day because it's absolutely horrendous. And for us not to give that information, you know, it wouldn't have felt right. So that's another reason as well why we did it till we started up the campaign, you know. And Sean would have wanted that to help people, you know.
It's an awful pity that great things come out of tragedies. Why do we have to wait till the tragedy for something good to come out of it? And why does it have to be our tragedy of our son? You know, but on the other side of the coin, if our son hadn't had sepsis, we still wouldn't know what it is. We'd still be ignorant to it, you know. We're trying to get there. We have a number of creches and home care companies now that have committed to adding sepsis awareness training to new and existing members of staff, and they've added to the website, you know. Now we've done that. We've achieved that.
Yeah, and it's a massive amount you've done in just a short space of time. I suppose for any parents who are listening to this and who maybe they might have a child who is sick or they might be sick themselves and they're now thinking, oh Lord, could this be something more? What are you looking for? What are the signs that you know, this is a normal infection that will run its course versus this could be sepsis?
The thing is, I found with Sean when I originally thought he had a flu, and a chest infection, you know, and the way I look at it, or the easiest way that I could tell anybody is if that person is not getting better, even with an antibiotic, and you feel that they're declining or you seem to be declining a bit more than getting better, you know, and some of the signs, like, I mean, Sean had probably 4 or 5 of them signs, which I didn't recognize because I knew nothing about sepsis. He had breathlessness. He had mottled skin. He wasn't passing urine in a day. You know, he was drinking a lot, but wasn't passing urine. And it's only now in hindsight, which is a great thing, that now I know the signs to look out for, you know. But I always tell people, if you have that gut feeling that your child or your loved one is not getting better, you know, think sepsis. And go present to A&E or your GP, or if you have to ring your GP, just say, look, I suspect sepsis and I don't want to alarm anybody or I don't want to be overthinking this, but don't be afraid to ask, could it be sepsis? Because they have a different mindset now in the hospitals too when you do ask, you know, which is great too, but just to be vigilant of, because not all the signs will present themselves as well. So that's all more reason to be vigilant and ask. And it's all about time as well, you know.
Nobody knows themselves, their own body better than you yourself. Nobody knows your child better than you. Or if there's a carer going into to somebody's home that knows they're out of sorts, they're acting differently than usual. If the infection seems to be progressing, because sepsis can hide behind any infection, but infection has to be present first. So one of the good things is with the pharmacies, we're looking at getting the pharmacies will be able to give out sepsis awareness information too now, going forward. You know, hopefully this is the way it'll go now with the Minister of Health at the moment. That's one of the plans he's looking at. You know, we know that doctors and the hospitals are quite busy. You know, look up the website. If you're in doubt, check it out. But it's always rule it out, because it's all about time, you know. And sepsis does not discriminate, you know. Sean was a 15-year-old, healthy, fit young man. No underlying health issues. So if he can get it, anybody can get it. Old, young, you know, people that have underlying health conditions are more susceptible to getting it. They're more likely to get it because they're more likely to get an infection. So we asked, you know, one of the things, if there's something that I don't understand, I would Google it. You know, instead of looking at the social media all of the time, just educate yourself. And if our website, Little Red's Legacy, or the HSC have it now, which wasn't there before our campaign, and they'll tell you that, and they thank us. They thank us for giving them the kick up the butt for doing what they're ready and now with it, you know? And I will go back to saying it's unfortunate, and I think it's a tragedy for something good to happen.
Yeah. And look, you've both clearly channeled something horrific in your own lives into something very positive, and you should be absolutely commended for doing that. I suppose, finally, the only question I'm going to have to ask, it is coming up with this 7th year anniversary. I mean, how are you both doing after nearly 7 years?
And good day of the mats, John. You know, every day is different. And as Joe said, the little grandson now, he keeps us going, which is great. You know, he's starting big school now, so my time is taken with him as well, and so is Joe's, and he keeps us going.
Does, yeah.
He really does, you know. And it's the fact that we're doing it for our heir, Sean, that keeps us going too. Keep his memory alive, keep his legacy going, you know, and we'd love to see it just forever. We really would. You know?
You know, we've had to get the snowball rolling. You know, let's keep it rolling.
That was Joe and Karen Hughes. And we chatted about how the signs of sepsis can be difficult to tell apart from other ailments. So let's get the medical view now. Michael O'Dwyer is the clinical lead for the National Programme for Sepsis and a consultant in intensive care medicine and anaesthesia at St. Vincent's University Hospital. And I started by asking him just what sepsis is.
It's a basic question. It's actually quite a complicated answer. It can be difficult to define to the public, and maybe best done with an example. But in broad strokes, sepsis is a syndrome that's triggered by an infection. And any infection can trigger sepsis, be that a bacterial infection, or certainly in the, you know, remembering what's gone on over the last couple of years, viruses, particularly COVID and influenza, can absolutely cause sepsis as well. It's important to state at the outset that the vast majority of infections will clear up by themselves or clear up with some antibiotics, time and some rest. And then a small proportion of these go on into that sepsis syndrome. Now, what happens here is the immune system that normally protects an individual against infection and eliminates that infection malfunctions and then begins to cause harm, cause organ failure and damage. That can be distant to where the infection started, so it becomes this whole body response. And sometimes it's easier to understand with an example, like if you were to cut your finger and it were to get infected, you'd notice it'd get red and swollen and it'd get sore, and then it would probably more than likely go away over a couple of days. You might have to go to the GP and have some antibiotics and it would all settle down. But in the case of sepsis, it doesn't settle down. And also important to note that even on antibiotics, on occasion, that sepsis can still persist and get worse. So in the case of sepsis developing from that, then you might notice that infection spreading and tracking from a finger up through the hands, some red marks. You might start to notice some lymph nodes that would be swollen in the armpit. And then as the syndrome develops, the signs that you see can be quite distant from where the infection started. So as the immune system begins to affect the lungs, even from a cut in the finger, you might notice that you're starting to breathe very fast. Similarly, as it might start to affect very commonly kidney function, you might notice that you're not peeing as much as you normally would. So this whole body response starts from one distinct infection. And that infection, people commonly think of it as a cut or an abrasion, and that's how sepsis starts. But the most common sources of sepsis are that initial infection are respiratory tract infections, so pneumonias, infections in the lungs, and also kidney and urinary tract infections would be the two most common places where these infections start and then develop from there into that whole body response that we call sepsis.
Okay, there's a lot to unpack in that. How many infections usually end up leading to sepsis in terms of percentage?
We don't have that data. We don't have that data because the number is very, very low. And if you imagine that the number, imagine your own case, the last time that you had to stay in bed for a day or two because you had a flu or a virus, or the vast majority of infections don't come to the attention of medical professionals, that most of them would cure up on their own. Like I say, a few of them with antibiotics. And so we don't really have that data, but to reassure people that we don't have that data because the number is very, very low. But having said that, the amount of times the population are exposed to an infection is very, very high. So even a very small percentage of that number still results in pretty high numbers that develop sepsis. And we in the National Clinical Program for Sepsis try to quantify this on a yearly basis with an annual report, and trying to find the number of people within the hospital system that develop or that are treated for sepsis. About 15,000 patients a year are treated within the public acute hospitals for sepsis. But we don't actually have numbers of how many infections lead to that amount of sepsis. But the percentage is very, very low that develops sepsis. When it develops, it can be a devastating illness with a mortality that's up to about 20% in most of the developed world. In the underdeveloped world, the mortality rate is much, much higher, where you don't have the specialist treatment facilities available to you, like antibiotics and intensive cares, where people can get a very intensive and invasive treatment for as long as it takes until the body responds and gets better.
Okay, and why is that mortality rate so high, even in cases where we have all of the benefits of modern medicine?
As an area of research, this has been hugely active for the last 50 years, and it's such a difficult disease to both treat and to diagnose firstly. Because the symptoms are so varied, they can masquerade as many, many different illnesses. And we don't have a very specific diagnostic test, which is unlike, say, other major diseases that have a significant impact on our health nationally, like, for example, heart attacks, strokes, things like that. You know, an ECG almost always will diagnose a heart attack, a CT will diagnose a stroke. We don't have that one single individual test that will diagnose sepsis. So it makes it very, very difficult to confirm that you have sepsis. And then by the very nature of that, sometimes treatment is delayed. And once that immune system starts to malfunction and can amplify itself up, it can lead very quickly to organ damage. And that organ damage can take quite a long time to repair itself. And then if you think of who our most at-risk groups are, they're the elderly. So you've got 60% of cases of sepsis are in that population that are 65 years and above. And that's the group of people who really struggle to survive what can be a couple of weeks or months or in an intensive care to get over their septic insult. So it can be difficult to diagnose, difficult to treat, and those patients who are at risk can be especially difficult to treat, and that they don't have as much time for recuperation as a younger population would.
So is there anything that makes you your infection more likely to become sepsis, either, you know, in the type of person or the type of infection it actually is?
Yeah, so that's a great question. There's a number of things that we can look at there. And at each point in that, there are increased risks. And there are some things that you as an individual would know about, and there are things that you don't know about. We know that there is a reasonably strong genetic link to develop sepsis from infections, but people may not know that. They may not know what their distant relatives have had. There are definitely specific bacteria and viruses that are more virulent than others and are more likely to result in severe infections and sepsis. And then for the patients themselves, there are definitely at-risk patient groups. And it's really got to do, and largely to do, with the immune system. And people with poorly developed immune systems are those individuals who are much more likely to develop a septic insult from an infection. And if you think of who the immune system can start and deteriorate in, it's that elderly population. So really 55 and above, the immune system doesn't work as well as it did when you're younger. And in very young children, neonates, their immune system hasn't developed properly either. So the risk is much greater in the older population, but there's also a small peak in that very young population. And then we see very frequently that the patients who develop sepsis and who do badly when they have sepsis are those that have other diseases as well, and particularly diseases that affect the immune system. And they might be cancers. Any cancer will make your outcome worse from a septic insult. And other conditions like inflammatory bowel disease, and really any other chronic condition, can make your chances of you developing sepsis from an infection. And then some of the treatments that you take to keep these diseases under control, because they frequently, those treatments affect the immune system as well. So people on chemotherapy for cancers, people who might be on biologic agents for inflammatory bowel disease or steroids, those patients are more at risk of developing a more severe response to an infection that can become sepsis.
When it comes then to recognizing the signs, and you've said how difficult it is to diagnose, if you are potentially worried or if you're seeing something you're not sure at, you know, it sounds like it's something that's quite hard to diagnose and to get a handle of. So what should you be looking out for if you're someone who has an infection, to maybe think, oh, could this be sepsis? Could this be something worse?
Yeah, so we try and describe the potential symptoms, and you could have all of these, you could have none of these. But if we run down through to take each letter of sepsis, and if you take that first S, a slurred speech or confusion, that's a really important symptom in the elderly population. And that might be the only thing that you would see. And that's not related to an infection like a meningitis that affects your brain function. These patients are getting confused from a urinary tract infection or from a kidney infection or from pneumonia. So that's a really important symptom. The E is for extreme shivering or extreme muscle pain. That pain out of any proportion to any injury that you've received is something that we hear time and again in survivors. The P, we say, is for passing no urine or for pee. And so again, that's when sepsis starts to affect your kidney function. You stop producing urine. So if you're not passing any urine, that can be a sign that you're developing sepsis. The other S would be for severe breathlessness that may develop whether you have an infection within the respiratory tract or outside. It might have nothing to do with your lungs at all. But again, that body-wide syndrome begins to affect your lungs and you feel breathless. The I is for patients, survivors who come back to us that they have this overwhelming feeling that I'm going to die. And that's something that we hear time and again in illness, and that you've never experienced anything like this. People know, and they know when things aren't right, and that's when they should really come and seek help. Final S then is for skin changes. And the skin, again, is your blood pressure would fall, and your skin might become cold and mottled and discolored. And so that's another symptom to look out for. And it's just, you know, a lot of cases are going to be picked up by people who are the primary carer of the patient. What I'd say to people is that you know that person better than anybody else, and you know when that person's not getting better. and you might know that they have an infection. They might even be on antibiotics, but that individual, they're not getting out of bed or up off the couch for a couple of days on end. They're just getting slowly worse. You know them, and you know that things aren't getting better. That is the time to go and seek help and to ask the question, could it be sepsis? Children are slightly different, only in that the symptoms look different, but the process is the same. So again, breathing is a very frequent feature, that they're breathing very fast. Children, rather than be confused, it's much more common for a child to have a fit or a convulsion. That's certainly a danger or a warning sign. Again, skin changes are common in children, and particularly in the case of a specific sepsis like meningitis, they might develop rashes that don't fade when you press on them with a glass tumbler. And then in the younger kids who can't tell you too much about what's going on, if they're difficult to wake and very lethargic, it's a sign to look out for. They feel cold when you touch them. The very young children then may not be feeding as they used to, vomiting repeatedly. And again, looking out for dry nappies in kids who aren't peeing is a sign that the kidney's becoming affected, and is definitely a sign to go and seek some help or advice.
So just to go back to the eye and expand on that a little bit, so people can get this just overarching sense that something is definitely wrong, that death is impending. Is that what it is?
Yes, and I think that's just people realizing that they have a very serious illness. I mean, I think lots of us, as we develop our seasonal colds and flus, you know, you stay in bed for a couple of days and I feel awful. I think you get this proportion of survivors that come back to us and say, I'm sorry, you didn't feel awful with your flu. This is what awful feels like. And it seems to be a very distinct sense of impending doom, that you've never been this sick before in your life.
Wow, that's fascinating. That's a really, really interesting one. A lot of what you're describing, as you've said, it sounds like there are many other things it could be when you were looking at it as a clinician. So as a clinician, how do you balance that idea of jumping the gun a little bit and thinking this is sepsis and maybe going down a route that it isn't, and actually getting in for that early diagnosis that is so important?
Yeah, it's really difficult. You know, we'll have some more facilities available to us than you know, obviously the public or a carer would. But some of those facilities become quite challenged, say in primary care and outside the setting of a hospital. Well, you're really just looking at temperatures and blood pressures, and it can be really, really very difficult for GPs and those involved in community care to pick it up. It's slightly easier for us in the hospital, where we have the benefit of blood tests, but very frequently the blood tests that we're looking for are not turned around in a quick enough time to allow us to make the diagnosis promptly. And then what that does is frequently coming in with early treatment, and that early treatment revolves around antibiotic treatment. And it's, you know, we try and train the HSE staff in the signs and symptoms of sepsis. And in that early treatment, and we have a GP portion to the program that's educating GPs on signs and symptoms of sepsis. Because the other side of this is that there's a really present danger in the overdiagnosis of sepsis. Similarly, the tragedies that are out there for people who've had delayed treatment and haven't had their antibiotics and perhaps could have had a better outcome is sort of lined up against the overuse of antibiotics throughout our community in many, many ways, but particularly in medicine. And you know, like a viral infection, although a viral infection can develop into sepsis, there's no benefit to treating a virus with antibiotics. So we just have to manage those competing risks, that if we over-treat with antibiotics, what we're going to have is a selection of bacteria that are resistant to the antibiotics that we're using, and then slowly over time we'll run out of antibiotics that'll be effective against sepsis and against our common illnesses. And we see this in other parts of the world really, really clearly, where there hasn't been proper controls over the prescription of antibiotics, where they're really running out of potential treatments for these infections and for sepsis syndromes.
That was Michael O'Dwyer, clinical lead for the National Clinical Programme for Sepsis. Now, it's something that you quite often would associate with a cut or an injury and an infection that way, and it getting into the blood, but it sometimes manifests without other symptoms Maeve Murphy is someone this happened to.
Hi, Sean. My name is Maeve Murphy. And this time 5 years ago, when I was 35, I ended up with sepsis. So I'm a busy mother of three. At the time, my kids were 7, 5, and 1 when I got sepsis unexpectedly.
And so tell us a bit about that. How did you figure it out? How did you know it? Or did you know at the start? Was it something that manifested itself as something that maybe seemed a million miles away from sepsis?
Oh, it certainly didn't. I had no inkling that that's what was going on with me. I just woke up one morning feeling unwell. We've all been there, you know, aches and pains, headache, flu-y, feverish, chills. And I just thought, look, I'll take the day in bed and I'll be feeling right tomorrow. But that day and that night, I didn't get any better. If anything, those shakes got worse during the night. And I didn't even have the energy to wake up and to get up and get a hot water bottle. And then the next morning, my husband was going to work. He said, how are you feeling? I said, I'm not much better. He said, look, get up and have your shower and, you know, you'll be fine then. So I got myself up, was pushing through. I put together a bolognese in the slow cooker, dropped the kids off at the childminder, even though I was almost doubled over at that stage, feeling unwell. And then the shakes came back. And I really couldn't do anything. They were a lot more severe. So at that stage, I did what we all do when we're feeling unwell. I rang my mom. And she was in a different county. So she rang my brother and sister, who were both in Cork and are both doctors. So my brother immediately was alerted that there was something wrong here. He said, Maeve, you know, you need to get yourself to the hospital. And I was saying, don't be ridiculous, Niall. You know, I'm not that unwell. But the compromise was that I would get myself as far as the GP. But my sister called over to see me, and this is probably 2 hours after I dropped the kids off at the childminders. And at that stage, I had a temperature of 42. I didn't know was it day or night, and I didn't recognize her. So immediately she knew that there was something very serious here, and she knew I had to get to hospital. So she tried to get me to walk down the stairs, but I couldn't. I couldn't walk. So not really sure. I think she kind of dragged me down the stairs and rang the ambulance at that point. And when the ambulance came, they weren't overly concerned. They kind of were thinking, oh, look, you're a busy mom. Look, you didn't even take your own temperature or have any paracetamol. Sure, you have the 2 paracetamol and you'll be feeling better. But my sister knew, no, this isn't right. This isn't what my sister is like. She knew my level of confusion wasn't normal. So she very much advocated for me and asked the ambulance staff to bring me up to CUH. And once I got there, then it was a very different story. Everything was taken very seriously. And I mean, I was so out of it at that stage that they asked me my date of birth, and I couldn't drag my date of birth from the depths of my memory. So that'll give you an insight into the level of confusion that was there because of the infection. Then in the hospital, staff were absolutely wonderful. I mean, we've all heard of the terrible stories of things being missed in the hospital and very, very sad stories. But I have to say, I got the best of care in CUH. They obviously could tell from my stats that there was something serious going on. And there was just a barrage of tests checking, was it meningitis? Was it pneumonia? Ruling out everything until the blood culture showed that it was an infection in my blood, otherwise known as sepsis.
And have you any idea how you got that infection?
No. To this day, Sean, I have no clue. Most people end up with sepsis, but they might have something underlying. They might be immunocompromised. So say they're very elderly or they're very young, a diabetic, they might be on immunosuppressants or on treatment for cancer. And quite often it's after they've had a recent surgery or given birth, or something as simple as a wound that's not healing. But in my case, there was nothing. There was nothing. There wasn't a urinary tract infection or a burst appendix. There was nothing to see what triggered this.
And how quickly, I suppose you said it was the blood cultures, but how quickly did the word sepsis come into things when it was something that presented so atypically?
I don't know how long that was. I mean, there was no official mention of sepsis until those blood results came back. So that would have been a number of hours. But ironically, that day when I arrived in the hospital, it was Friday the 13th of September. Friday the 13th is unlucky for some, but for me, it was very lucky. It was World Sepsis Awareness Day, and every member of staff was wearing a badge that said, "Think sepsis." So perhaps, I'm not sure, but I always think that perhaps for that reason, it might have been a little bit more to the forefront of the staff's mind.
And I suppose what was, when you started to come a bit more around to it and were thinking a bit more rationally, maybe, what was going through your head? Because you have obviously two doctors in the family, as you were saying, that you would think, oh, we can get to the bottom of something fairly quickly or they'll give me good advice. But when it's something that comes like this, so out of the blue, what was going through your mind?
I suppose in those initial few days, I couldn't really process it. Certainly, even when my husband, he was at my bedside when they told us that it was sepsis. And I can remember him just saying, okay, yeah, okay, okay. But not really having any, you know, concept of how serious that was. But like I said, it was World Sepsis Awareness Day. And on the back of the paper that day was the story of someone with sepsis who wasn't as lucky as I was, another young person. And I think when he read that, I'll never forget the look on his face. He was haunted reading it when he realised how close we came to a real tragic story.
What is the recovery from sepsis like?
I suppose it's different for everyone. But for me, I mean, when I was leaving the hospital, the doctors were trying to explain, oh, you're going to have to take it easy now for a while. You know, this is going to take some time. And I mean, I was a young, fit 35-year-old. I was like, oh, yeah, I'll be fine in a day or two. I was self-employed and thinking, there's no way I'm taking any time off work. I'll be back in a day or two. But when I got home, I realised that couldn't be possible. The level of fatigue and exhaustion was incredible. So much so that if I changed my one-year-old's nappy, I'd have to take to the bed for hours again. Even that level of physical exertion had exhausted me. The brain fog was huge. It was like wading through custard. That took a few weeks certainly to settle down. My hair was coming out in clumps. My taste was affected. And also, I would say there was certainly a level of insomnia set in as well for a while. I think partially because it was a sepsis of unknown origin. So if you knew there was a clear origin for being sick, it was, you know, you could label that and say, well, that's over and that's gone. But in my case, there was nothing to suggest that it wouldn't come back again. And that in itself would keep you awake at night a bit, all right.
Yeah, it's funny just saying all those things. I had cancer myself in the last year, and a lot of that sounds actually very close to the recovery from chemotherapy, which is sort of a remarkable thing to think and compare it to. You're saying a lot of things, and I'm thinking, yeah, that sounds very familiar. And I suppose that makes an element of sense that if it is a poisoning in the blood, that it does go around and affect everything, which is maybe something you wouldn't, certainly I had never thought about before.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think everyone, unfortunately, is very aware of the effects of chemotherapy on the body and the recovery from that. But because sepsis isn't as well known, that perhaps people don't realise it. And like you said, chemotherapy is effectively trying to kill off, you know, the bad cells in your body. And, you know, the poison in your body from sepsis, really, from the infection, is something kind of similar, I suppose, really.
Yeah,
it's amazing. Yeah, it affects every part of your body.
Completely. Yeah, it's mad. I just something I never would have considered before. I suppose there'll be a lot of people listening
who will be terrified right now, because, you know, what you're saying, they're like, what if that's happening to me, or how does it happen? So if we're looking out for it, you've mentioned a couple of the signs when you cut yourself and other things that can lead to an infection that can lead to sepsis. But what are the major signs to watch out for that, okay, this isn't just me being sick or having a down week or whatever. This is something maybe I need to take a bit more seriously and get to a GP or to a hospital.
I think if someone isn't getting better, you know, if you have a wound and the redness around it is getting bigger, say if you circle it with a pen and the following day it's bigger again, that's a sign that you're not getting better, you're getting worse. You know, I think in my case, the shaking, the rigoring was something showing that it wasn't just a regular, oh, I'm feeling a little bit under the weather. And I think as well, we do have to be, just keep it. I mean, my situation was quite unlikely, but we do have to keep it at your back of your mind. It's worth asking your healthcare provider, look, could this be sepsis? Is there a chance that it's something like this? And actually, recently, I met a friend of mine, and she had a similar story. Now, in her case, it didn't turn out to be as progressed as far as sepsis. But she said having heard my story made her go to her healthcare provider quicker. And her GP wasn't sure what it was and sent her to hospital. And she ended up spending a few weeks in hospital with IV antibiotics for very serious illness that could have progressed to sepsis if maybe she'd waited another 12 hours before it ending.
So I suppose a good bit of advice maybe would be to always ask someone or tell someone, because when you were saying if it's your sister and that you didn't recognize her, she knew or she had an awareness outside of yourself to say, okay, you're not right here. That maybe none of us spot when we are getting sick or are sick ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I was quite unaware, really. You know, you probably need somebody close to you that can say, gosh, this isn't normal. I'm getting worried. Look, let's get this checked out.
Maeve, that's absolutely great. Thank you so much for chatting to me. Is there anything about your story or about sepsis in general that we didn't get to or I didn't ask about that you think is definitely worth mentioning?
I suppose, you know, they say that sepsis is one of the biggest killers in the world. It's more people die from sepsis and cancer worldwide. Not in Ireland, no, but worldwide. I think that is a shocking fact people are unaware of. And in Ireland, there's more people die of sepsis than they do of heart attacks.
That's absolutely mad.
Isn't it? Yeah. And I think as well, yeah, some of the other symptoms that you would be looking out for are mottled skin or a rash in children, confusion, the high temperature, being unable to walk, the fever, chills, aches and pains. Headache, yeah, they're all the main things.
And that was Maeve Murphy, who herself had sepsis. I hope you learned something from this episode. Certainly I did, and it was very interesting and kind of eye-opening, I have to say, listening to our guests. And maybe we all have a bit of a better awareness of the signs of sepsis and when something might be a little bit more than an infection and something to worry about a little bit more. Maybe my thanks to the guests who spoke to me today. I will be back next week with another episode of Let Me Explain.